Well, I think that it's clear that the U.S. and its NATO allies believe that they would be able to carry off this operation and their intervention. You know, the revolution, as the other speaker called it, started with many people with grievances against the government from the right, the center, and even some from the left gathered together. But as that movement evolved, the fascist elements became a critical element in it and helped to bring about, played actually a key role. After an agreement was supposedly reached on February 21st, they played a key role in driving out the existing government. The U.S. and its allies stood with them. John McCain, Victoria Nuland, representing the State Department, representing the United States, appear in many photos with the leader of the fascist Svoboda Party and other right-wingers. They believed that they could do this, that they could do it without getting the kind of resistance that they're seeing from Russia and from a large part of the Ukraine itself. They overplayed their hand in this. Now what will they do? Are they in a position, if the new referendums take place, are they going to intervene? Are they going to enact new sanctions? In all likelihood, they are going to enact new sanctions if those referendums take place. But really, the situation, if they want to escalate it further, presents something of the greatest danger. I mean, we're talking about the two countries that have the largest number of nuclear weapons of any countries on Earth. So the danger of escalation, and I'm not predicting that there's about to be nuclear war or something like that, but the escalation ladder is frequently climbed without either side wanting to get to war, but the steps climbing the ladder can inexorably lead to something beyond which either side originally anticipated. So we have to see this as an extremely dangerous crisis, and we have to see that it's the Western intervention that has caused it to become the crisis that it is. It's the US-NATO intervention. They wanted to take Ukraine in, not only to the European Union, but into NATO. They wanted to take NATO right up to the border of Russia. That was their anticipation. That's what they were hoping for and thinking was going to happen. And of course, the Russian government could not allow that to transpire.
Right. Well, let's talk about the gas topic again, Peterson, since you brought it up before. And I'm wondering, when we talk about a country, for example, like Germany, who relies on 30 to 40% of its gas from Russia, do you really think that Germany's going to put the gun against their head and shoot themselves and not have this sale come from Russia towards them? And from what I understand, technically, at this point, there's no way that there could be any type of gas that can be docked at ports to be brought into Germany other than from Russia coming through Ukraine. I mean, how do you think that Germany is going to back down? Do you think that the European Union as a whole, we're going to see them as being remaining united, or we're going to see them back down, like in the case that I'm thinking with Germany that's going to happen?
Well, I think that the states in the European Union will honor their contracts with Russia and expect Russia to honor theirs. It's not the first time that Russia has used Ukraine as a political crisis point to use gas as a leverage. So this leverage aspect is what troubles the West. So Russia has to be seen as a less than, Gazprom has to be seen as a less than steady partner. The idea then is that if you agree with everything politically that Russia does, oh, then you'll get your gas without any problems. But this is a situation that over time will evolve towards greater diversity in the sourcing of gas for Western Europe. And this use of gas as a political point will lose its, will cost Russia in the end quite a bit, I believe. So I don't think anyone in the West is going to look to change the contracts drastically. But I think there's a sense now that this tying it to political situations is something that they don't really want. It's not good business. And when many people were questioning the future of NATO, well, now you have a reason for NATO to actually have a sense of itself again, because Russia is intimidating and using the border as to build up and act as a military intimidation. It's military intimidation itself alone that is enough to make NATO realize it's important to keep that alliance going. If you look closely, you'll see that the United States has not armed Ukraine. So Ukraine is at a disadvantage in anything military conflict with Russia. It's also at a disadvantage as Russia uses agents provocateurs.
Well, let me ask you this then. I'm sorry to jump in, Peterson. Do you believe the accusation made by the Kremlin against the U.S. in terms of the security firm known as Blackwater, or in this case, I'm talking about Greystone, I guess if you want to call it a offshoot of Z Services, as Blackwater has become known, of which Russia says there are about 150, perhaps more, mercenaries that are in the eastern part of the country. Do you believe that accusation? I should note that Greystone has come out categorically denying this.
Well, the thing is to get pictures of them and IDs. You need to know who they are. If you make an assertion like that, a broad assertion, you need to have a lot more evidence than they have shown.
Well, what about the evidence then of Russia?
I think Peter is turning things upside down.
Go ahead, Richard Becker, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not Russia that has moved westward over the last 20 years since the fall of the Soviet Union. It's the U.S. and NATO, and the U.S. is the dominating power in NATO, that has moved eastward, despite assurances to Russian leaders that they would not do so back in the 1990s. So they said, well, no, we won't incorporate the former Warsaw Pact countries into NATO. Well, now Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary are all full members of NATO. The others, the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, have a NATO relationship. The U.S. has tried everything to move its forces eastward. What is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization anyways? I mean, it's expanding. It seems to have become a worldwide organization, and it's been an organization of aggression. The clear aim is to surround Russia, to weaken Russia, in the long run, to bring about regime change in Russia, because Russia, despite being much weaker than when it was part of the Soviet Union, still constitutes an obstacle to U.S. global domination. I don't think that anyone who looks objectively at the picture of the last 20 plus years can see the situation any differently in terms of NATO's aggressiveness toward Russia.
Well, and let's go with that line.
I do.
Go ahead, Peterson.
Instead of seeing NATO as moving eastward, I see democracy moving eastward. I see states wanting to be not part of a Russian zone of influence, but to be their own states, to make their own decisions. And it is Russia that has been trying to maintain this idea of zones of influence, that they should be able to influence the politics of the states that surround them. It was Putin that saw the end of the Soviet Union as the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. I don't. I see instead the success of moving real democracies into the East is why the East has now become such an affluent area.
So you equate democracy with NATO. With militarism.
Go ahead, repeat your question, Richard.
You equate democracy with militarism?
No, I don't.
You seem to be saying that because
equate democracy
Poland,
with real
Germany,
elections.
Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia were incorporated into NATO after the fall of the socialist governments in those countries, quite a while afterwards. The expansion of NATO is meant to carry out the U.S. aim of global domination. I don't think that there can be any question about that. It's not about democracy. You know, the United States government doesn't care about democracy. It's fine with Saudi Arabia, where there's never been an election and women can't drive cars, and numerous other dictatorships around the world. I think that's just a kind of naive myth.
Well, talk about democracy. And Peter Sinnott, you talk about elections. We had a boxer who's not running for the elections, and now we have the chocolate king. And I'm talking about billionaire candy manufacturer Petro Poroshenko. What do you think about him? Do you think he's going to be elected? He says his mission is to take his country into Europe while making peace with Putin.
People, We'll have to see how the elections work out. But the reality is that it's not surprising that there'd be a business interest. He might be looked upon, possibly, as someone who's been able to be successful in running an enterprise in a country that was very poor and had very difficult times. So some may see that his ability to have some level of success commercially as translating into being able to manage and to maybe build the economy of Ukraine. I certainly don't want to be seen as a supporter of him. But this idea of democracy, of real elections as opposed to false elections like Crimea, is, I think, the key point. And I think that many in the West see this. NATO is, after all,
I'm going to jump in because we're fresh out of time. Just for some concluding remarks there from Richard Becker, all the gains the U.S. May have made against Russia, I think Richard Becker is now pretty much going to be thrown out the door if they continue with the threat of sanctions. How do you see this relationship unraveling, I should say?
Well, first of all, you have to say that this is the first person I've heard question the election. The first person I've heard question the validity of the election that took place in Crimea. I mean, there hasn't been any dispute that 95% of the population that came out to vote voted in favor of seceding from Ukraine and becoming part of the Russian Federation. And for the reasons that I stated earlier, they don't want to live under the regime that exists in Kiev now and see it as a threat to their future. If the United States continues with its policy of sanctions, you know, it really will increase the tension. And we really also have to ask the question, why is it that the United States never faces sanctions itself for its aggression in Iraq and Afghanistan, its drone warfare, and its many interventions over many, many decades?
Very well. We're going to leave it on those questions that you just posed there. Thank you very much. Western Regional Coordinator of Answer Coalition, Richard Becker. Also like to thank Peter Sinnott, independent scholar who spoke to us from New York. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tawai and the entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye.